Damn, Miss Linda. I check on you and you check on me.
But you hadn't forgotten that time when I helped you out when you needed me, and it wasn't much.
I ain't gonna never forget that. That's the only reason why I'm still here, because I got some help, you know. But these Negroes and sisters, I'm trying to help nothing.
Wrong way.
All right, Miss Linda, I got two calls.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, so I want to say good night to everybody, okay? And Dr. Jones, are you still there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm still here. I put it on mute because I'm driving.
Oh, well, next time, if I send you a text, please respond.
I will most certainly respond, ma'am.
Okie dokie, so y'all take care, right?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for calling us, Linda. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, good night.
Good night. 6029, welcome to Sign of the Times. Who are we speaking with?
Peace Queen, Haki.
Oh, Peace, how you doing?
No, Haki, I'm fine, sister. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm just listening, you know. I assume you guys earlier were talking about gentrification.
Yes. What'd you say your name?
Haki.
Haki?
Yes, Haki.
Okay. I'm sorry, brother. I was at you to, but I'm gonna work it out.
Okay. Yeah, I think one of the things is that to some extent, I think we're caught up in the matrix, and despite the kind of things that are going on, the adverse impact on our lives, a lot of us are totally oblivious to reality. One of the things I struggle with daily is understanding that that particular character. How is it that you're subjected to the worst of the worst, whether it be policy, whether it be access to resources, or just in terms of socially, you know, being recognized as a human being? How in the world do you not acknowledge or not see this reality? But nonetheless, it's a sociological point, but nonetheless, I think that it is something that, on some level, I think is very, very, very disturbing. Particularly, I think when you think about what's happening to us, we can't divorce it from the overall state of the economy. And this is the thing that people have to understand. When we talk about the decline of capitalism, we talk about the decline of the global economic system. A couple things we have to understand. First and foremost, we have to understand that a lot of these problems that we see with respect to the economy are done intentionally. It's not an accident. Secondly, I think we have to understand that one of the things that is so important in terms of, as strategically speaking, is that you have to have scapegoats in terms of being able to pull it off, in terms of ruling class actually being able to pull off, you know, this weakening of the economy to the detriment of so many people, you know, not just in America but throughout the world. So the scapegoats are indispensable. I think our people at this point, most of us should realize, of course a lot of us don't realize, that scapegoat happens to be us. And not only does it create a certain amount of precariousness in terms of, you know, our existence. I mean, clearly our existence in society is very precarious. But more importantly, because, strategically speaking, that because we're so useful in terms of being scapegoats, you know, for what's going on in society, that ultimately what happens is that the drive toward actually annihilating those you perceive as somewhat a burden on society becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And this is the problem that we got to understand. So when you talk about the fact that, you know, when these people, you know, arbitrarily create policies which people are victimized simply because of where they live or the color of their skin, then in essence what the system is saying is that your existence is esoteric, that you don't have, your existence is not really important. So therefore, we can do anything and everything to you because your existence isn't important. And this is the problem in terms of when we talk about the economy, in terms of the decline of the economy, the real danger to our people, in which we've got to begin to understand. So we don't have any other choice but to organize and to stand up, because it's a question of life and death. As much as people like to believe, even middle-class African folks like to believe that, you know, that everything's okay and that they're set for life, the reality is that you're not set for life. And the economy is very clear on that point. increasingly, day by day, more and more people find themselves homeless who have them big jobs making lots and lots of money, who find themselves no longer, you know, accessible to these jobs making lots and lots of money. People are struggling to pay the rent or the mortgage, or people are struggling just to feed their children. This stuff is an everyday occurrence for a lot of people in society, particularly African people. And for us to believe somehow that this is all a mirage, you know, it boggles my mind. But nonetheless, a lot of our people do believe that. But we have to come to the realization that, in fact, that not only is our existence precarious, but we are in danger in terms of being eliminated, eradicated, liquidated, whatever you want to call it, killed off in the society. Now, of course, historically speaking, not everybody stands to be eliminated. Of course, so I don't want to engage in any type of, you know, histrionics, you know, where, you know, I give the impression that somehow that all African people in America are in danger of being eliminated. Of course, that's not the situation. That wouldn't happen. But certainly, a thousand of us will be affected, and certainly, to a large extent, I think that most of us certainly will be marginalized in terms of our quality of life, in terms of being able to deliver to our children the kind of things they need in terms of being the best they can be, are greatly restricted or undermined. So we have to understand that we are under attack. And it is a question that we try to convey to our folks on a serious level. But to a large extent, in order for our people to adequately appreciate when we talk about being under attack and when we talk about the precarious nature of our existence in society, we have to understand the decline of the capitalist system. And we have to understand that. And so when people like George Bush, Karl Rove, Richard Pearl, Wolfowitz, and people like the very powerful people, when they're talking about in terms of, democracy, or when they talk about saving the global economy, it's a euphemism for, in order for us to maintain power, in order for us to maintain hegemony, we have to, out of necessity, kill off lots and lots of people. Even though when you listen to the media, they talk about the liquidation of people throughout the world, we see these wars being conducted by the United States in the West against people of color throughout the world. But we have to understand that same process in terms of this drive to just destroy people also exists right here in America. And for African people not to realize that the inherent danger that we're confronted with boggles my mind. So organization is the only real solution we have in terms of standing up. But first and foremost, we have to have some collective understanding in terms of what it is that we're up against. Unless we do, then it's inconceivable for us in terms of being able to organize and to stand up and to fight against oppression. So this is the problem that we're confronted with in terms of the decline of this capitalist system. And this is the real danger. And so even when we talk about gentrification, one of the things we have to understand, and I'm conclude with this because I can talk for the next couple of hours. But let me just say this and to conclude. One of the things is that I think when we talk about decline of capitalism, one of the things when we talk about gentrification society, one of the things we have to understand, when these people spend trillions and trillions of dollars to fight wars around the world, that fundamentally means less and less money for this economy. With less and less money in this economy, there's no money in terms of, injected into the system. So therefore, it's impossible for the system to expand, because there's no money going through it. Capitalism is predicated on the flow of money or the velocity of money going through the system. Well, if there's no money going through the system, then the economy contracts. So what happens is that less and less money available for the system, which means that the only access that has the money comes from in terms of, extracting from those in society who at least have some access to some resources, okay? Which means that in the cases of the cities, the people who they attract, of course, are white folks who have access to some monies. And African people, those who have no access to monies, get gentrified. They can no longer live in the cities. And so, therefore, it's a process which, I think it seems to me at some level, people have to begin to understand that even though, this is a very benign process, ultimately it has much broader ramifications in terms of our right to exist as human beings in a society. And so whether or not our people come to realization in terms of the problems that we're confronted with, it's to a large extent going to depend on how many of us actually survive in the society. So I'm not trying to engage in hyperbole, or I'm not trying to engage in scare tactics, or I'm not trying to engage in any of that stuff in terms of to mislead anybody. I'm just trying to lay out the cold, hard reality in terms of when we talk about, being at war, that this is not a figment of my imagination. This is, in fact, very, very real.
Ashe, I yield to you, Dr. Jones.
I can barely hear you guys. My reception's real bad right now. So just keep going
okay.
with what you guys are doing.
Okay. Well, brother, I think that you're absolutely on point. One of the things that we've talked about here, and Brother Blacksmith has been a guest on Sign of the Time previously, is that the economic collapse here is real, very real. And he was talking about more on a global level how that's going to have an effect on us. Just like we're talking about now, like you said, gentrification on a local level is going to have an effect on us. So you're absolutely on point, and I unite with your point, first off. Second of all, let me ask you this, because this has come up, too, in those conversations about economics and the petrodollar and the creation of BRICS and the development of the African Union and their, I guess, steer towards establishing, you know, their own currency and the dollar not being accepted as many places as it used to be and things like that. So we've had that economic conversation. I want to get your opinion, though. If, say, there was or, as has been predicted, is going to be a crash of the dollar to the point where even if those who are, quote-unquote, wealthy, if the dollar has no value, right, then they're basically playing with monopoly money. If that were to happen, how do you think that that would have an effect on, or if at all, on leveling the playing field? And what do you think the response could be to that?
You know, I don't think necessarily that the decline or the crash of the dollar is going to somehow necessitate a level playing field. I think first and foremost, we have to understand, when we talk about the crash of the dollar, we're talking about where the dollar has no real value. But nonetheless, many dollars have some value. And so therefore, those billionaires, those multi-billionaires, of course, have access to even if they don't have access to dollars, they have access to other types of currency in terms of being able to be viable economically. So I think when we talk about the decline, you know, decline of the dollar, I mean, it's a conscious policy. They're consciously doing that. One of the things is that when you look at the situation where right now, where there's a recently there was a former Federal Reserve official out of Dallas, Texas, and he talked about a situation where the U.S. particularly the government with the help of the Federal Reserve front loading the economy. In other words, you have a situation where you have the federal government buying off all of these government bonds. It gives the impression that the economy is doing well, but in fact, what it does, it undermines the economy. Because what happens is that not only does it increase in terms of, when you talk about something like, for instance, if you talk about the value of the dollar, okay? Now, the whole reason in terms of doing that is to increase the value of the dollar. It's all about the money. It's all about the money. But here's the problem is that with the increase in the value of the dollar comes the increase in terms of debt, which means that the problem they created is self-inflicted. So overall, when we talk about the overall functioning economy, it does nothing in terms of improving the economy. On the contrary, it causes the economy to contract, and that's precisely what they want to do. So what they're doing, they're trying to force that. And so the process, when we talk about the value of the dollar, as inflation goes up, of course, the value of the dollar goes down, right? So what happens is that's precisely what they want to do. That's precisely what they want to do. But the ramifications as they relate to our people, we have to understand, is that because so many people out here do not understand how capitalism works, that the inclination that somehow the African people are the problem or the result of the decline or destruction of the economy, it's just in the minds of a lot of people, has some relevancy. And this is the danger that I keep talking about, that we have to understand. So those people out there who are greatly impacted in terms of the decline of the economy are going to look for someone to victimize. Someone must be the price. Someone must be the scapegoat. But that scapegoat is us. And so when we talk about the overall function of the global economy in terms of, you know, how things work, then we got to be very, very clear. You know, see, if this was a situation that's something that was haphazard or something that merely would result of, you know, bad economic policy, that's one thing. But when it's contrived, when people are constantly trying to drive down the value of the dollar, okay, it does have a deleterious impact in terms of the overall functioning of the economy. Another thing, one of the things you talked about the BRIC nations, you know, one of the things is that it's a very good thing that that the BRIC nations, in particular, were in China and Russia being the spearhead of that movement, in terms of creating, well, also in South America, being the spearhead in terms of actually creating your own banks. Because one of the things is that clearly, in terms of when you talk about hegemony, and when you talk about Western domination, the way in which they've been able to dominate is controlling the money supply. And so by creating your own banks, your own financial institutions, you make it impossible for, you don't have to go to them anymore to borrow money. As a matter of fact, what happened recently as 2 months ago, China was successful in forcing the International Monetary Fund actually to accept the yuan, the Chinese currency, as part of that basket of currencies that people could actually borrow from. And so China, as you know, has been doing a great investment throughout the world, particularly in Africa, because they understand the power, not only in terms of resources in Africa, but also in terms of the potential that exists in Africa. And so China's been investing heavily in there. And now, keep in mind, because the United States recognized that kind of move undermines their push for hegemony, meaning that there has to be a response for the United States in terms of making sure that this creation of banks, independent banks, doesn't exist. As a consequence, what happens is that you have military bases throughout the world, and particularly in Africa, that's specifically designed to make sure to keep China in check, so China cannot continue to build Africa's infrastructure. But what does that mean nationally or locally? It means the militarization of the police, because what happens is that because without access to resources, then the people get angsty. So, which means that you're going to have some institution in place to keep them in check, which means police force, violence, and killing of African people in particular. So when we talk about the impact, overall impact in terms of the declining economy or decline of the dollar, it does have ramifications both on the international scene as well as the local scene. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand the correlation between the two. They see the situation that happened around the world as somehow isolated from what's going on inside of America, when in fact, they're the same thing. Nationally, when we talk about decline of the economy, we're talking about capitalism. When we talk about the decline of the global economy, we're talking about fascism, okay, or neoliberalism. It's the same thing. But people don't understand that because the capitalist media does a very good job of confusing people around the issues. And so, therefore, people don't understand that when they see all these wars going around the world, what does that fundamentally mean to them? It means a lack of a future for their children, and people don't necessarily understand that.
Ashe, thank you, brother. I'm going to have you on the air. I'm going to go ahead and open up the next call. I'm going to leave you open as well. That's how we do it here a lot of times. We respect a lot of that arguing and stuff don't go on. But I'm going to leave you open. Welcome. Who are we speaking to?
Hello?
Oh.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, this is Brother Ajay Tame. I got to give you all a big apology for being so late. But I was I'm out flyering trying to start our community program called Harlem Liberation School. And honestly, I lost track of the time. I've been on 125th Street all day passing out flyers. So how is everyone doing?
Peace.
Great. Dr. driving. He's going to call right back in a few minutes. So actually, you're right on time.
Okay. Would you mind if I gave a little addition to what the brother was talking about? Do I have time?
Yes, sir. Please do.
Okay. So first of all, thank you for having me on. My name is Ajay Kayimba. I'm based in Harlem, and I recently wrote on my True Sense blog an article talking about really focusing more on the gentrification going on in Harlem, but looking at that as a lens to understand what's going on to, you know, black communities around the country. And understanding that some people listening, you know, may not be familiar with a lot of terms, I'm going to try to speak very concisely in a language everybody can understand. Gentrification, there's a lot of ways that the social scientists, economists explain it. And they range from being very, very dense to being very clear. Some economic, some social. I'm going to put it like this. When we talk about gentrification as it relates to urban black communities, we're talking about nothing less than the fragmentation of our culture, of our economic structure, and of our lives. It has to be seen in that way for us to take it seriously enough to organize and mobilize to change that trend. In Harlem, for example, if you look at after the Great Migration, you had numbers in Harlem, the percentage of blacks were something around 60 to 70%. In 1950, the percentage of blacks was 98%. You know, so that by the 60s, Malcolm could say that Harlem was the black Mecca, more black people in Harlem than anywhere else in the country. As of 1990s, around 1990, certainly by 2000, the percentage is now up in Harlem is 40%. So in 50 years' time, it went from 98% black people to 40% black people. Now, a lot of people talking about the issue, writing about it, they talk about the cultural piece. Oh, you know, the white people come, we can't play our music. The white people come, you know, they're annoying. The white people come and, you know, we feel bad that they're kind of acting kind of colonial with us. Those things are important for sure. But what needs to be told about more, in my opinion, is the political and economic impact of gentrification, you know, in our local neighborhoods. So what happens is the crack epidemic started, actually the heroin epidemic in the 70s, which then became the crack epidemic in the 80s, basically created a situation where huge numbers of black people were carted off to prison under the Rockefeller drug laws and the RICO Act. It became a very violent neighborhood, so some people left willingly seeking safer places to live, principally places like North Carolina and Atlanta. And the ones who remained had a very tough time sustaining themselves. The buildings were dilapidated in the Bronx. The white landlords were burning the buildings down to get their insurance, and they were cutting out. Right? So the whites that were here were bouncing because they were scared, you know, the violence and all of this dilapidated buildings. So what happened was the property value all over Harlem went down. And in fact, there was a time in the 80s where they were saying you could buy brownstones for $1 if you promised to rehabilitate or renovate them. Right? For $1. Those same brownstones now sell at a minimum of $1.5 million. So once they threw in the drugs, had it violent, had people scared to live here, police going crazy on people, that brought the value down, people left. That now left room for whites and others to come in, buy this property dirt cheap, and start gentrifying the neighborhood. Now, the point of this is not simply that they come in and they change the culture. Is that they come in and displace us. The property value shoots up, and long-time residents of the city, of the area, can no longer afford to live there. So some people are forced to move to other cities because they can no longer afford the place where they grew up, born and raised. As a case in point, to get an apartment, for instance, to just get a room will cost you more than $400 a week, or excuse me, $200 a week to get a room. To get a studio apartment may cost you up to $1,400. To get a one or two bedroom, forget about it. So there's people paying $1,800 and up, barely surviving. And then if you add to that all the numbers that were displaced, had to move out of the community, then you add to that the white people building businesses that naturally cater to their taste and their sensibilities. So all of the local bar lounges that were black-owned when I came up are almost completely all gone, including the famous Lenox Lounge, a whole bunch of them gone, most of them replaced by real blockbuster franchise businesses, Red Lobsters and Joe's Crab Shack, and all this other stuff, or white bar lounges that has a whole different clientele. So what happens is we get displaced. We have no economic power. We don't own businesses. We're not on the community boards. We're not on the school boards. The whole complexion of the community changes. White folks are getting on the community board of these different places in the city, making decisions that impact us, and we're not there. Or they get on the school board and make decisions. Or they're trustees of corporations making decisions in our neighborhood. And even the community centers now are catering to white and upper-class clientele. I was searching for a place to do a Harlem Liberation School, and all the places wanted $500, $800, $1,000 per night. You can't possibly afford that during a community program. So even the so-called community centers began catering to the upper-class clientele, and they priced the community right out of the community. So if you don't have a black business that's willing to say, we'll let you do your program here for free or nominal cost, then you're out of luck. Then it has a political impact. As more whites come in, and we can't forget the Latinos, and I want to be clear and not disrespecting the Latinos, but we have to be clear that they're part of this issue too, because Latinos are now the majority in every section of Harlem. This would be Central, West, and East, overwhelming majorities. Now, what that means is the school culture changes. Now in the elementary schools, they have they're very big on the bilingual classes. They're very big. They're catering to that clientele because they're the majority, you know. So you have classes now where you barely see many African-American kids and where the emphasis is not on their particular cultural educational needs because the emphasis is going to another group of people's educational and cultural needs. The staff is not majority black. The principals, the assistant principals, the guidance counselors, they look like and speak to the interests of other people. So now, when you add all of this together, you find now that on the block that I grew up on 143rd, between Broadway and Amsterdam Hall, the three, five black ladies, all black businesses growing up. None of those businesses are there. And on this one particular block, there are no black-owned businesses. The Caribbean Place is closed down. George's Donut Shop and Bakery closed. All these businesses are gone. You can barely find a black barber shop. So I want people to understand this is not only an issue of, let's say, black and white. You have to add other people. Asians have to be entered into the mix, and Latinos have to be entered into the mix. Now, why this is important is because these people see themselves as a nation, or at least as a dormant nation, a nation, a potential nation, and they act that way. They're on community boards making decisions that affect their people and help their people. They're the first to know about openings in buildings, residential buildings. They're the supers of these buildings. They're running for the city council. They're doing all these, taking over these sites of power. So this means it's going to affect the politics of Harlem and other cities because the resources are scarce and you have these special interest groups all fighting, all vying for attention and for scarce resources. So it leaves us in a position that the three brothers were in what was that Spike Lee movie? I think it was, what was that? I forget the name of the fight. With Radio Ryan.
Do the right thing.
Do the right thing. And they're sitting on the side, on the corner outside of a building, complaining about the fact that a Korean owns the store and they're taking over. It leaves people in this very passive position of complaint. But what I'm hoping, the blog article I wrote, I know Brother Dr. Jones wrote an article, I'm hoping people understand this is deeper than just questions of the community is changing. It's like if people don't organize, politically educate themselves on this issue, and do the things necessary to reclaim their neighborhoods, we will be gone from here. Because it used to be they pushed everybody to the Bronx. But guess what? The Bronx now is going through gentrification. You know, so now it's like, where are you going to go? It's going to be New York City is going to be some type of a resort for the rich and the upper class, you know, and with that you lose all the culture and the history. So in my article, what I'm suggesting people do, we got to get out of the complaining state. We have to see what it is, and we got to get out of the meaningless debates. Is it on purpose? Did a bunch of white men sit down and conspire? It doesn't matter. The cause at this point, what matters is what's the outcome of it. And the condition, as I said in my article, is look who owns the businesses. Look who's on the city council community board. Look who's the principal, assistant principal, guidance counselor, librarian. You see? And when you see the outcome, it doesn't matter if this was intentional or accidental. The outcome is a negative one, negatively impacts us, and so we must respond. And what I suggest is a few things. Number one, certainly we have to have a focus on building community cooperatives. Everybody thinks capitalism is the only way. And sure, we can have some capitalist businesses too. But I think somewhere in there we need to start thinking about how do we build community cooperatives where larger groups of our community have input in decision-making, work for the company, and financially benefit from the company. Can afford to give people affordable goods and excellent quality and service. Also, we need to look at all these black people got their money tied up in these white banks. These white banks are using their money to accrue interest and to make investment. And we have no black businesses. Well, what does it take to have a black business? You need capital. Most of us can't go to grandma, mom, or cousin or aunt and get $250,000. So this means we must go to a bank. And guess what? The banks are not lending black people too much money in terms of business loans. So this means that one thing we need to do is start talking about building credit unions in our own banks, not to mention that we should also start threatening to take our money out of these white banks until they have a certain percentage or whatever of loans that go to our people. There's no reason why we live in this community, we got money in these banks, and then you go to get a business loan, and you can't get a business loan. You know, so there's a few things, and then to educate our people about this. But if we have to have an economic response, we have to picket, we have to boycott, we have to start withdrawing our resources. There's a lot of things we can do, but what we can't afford to keep doing is simply labeling this as a cultural problem, and we can't afford to keep sitting down and complaining about what group is running our communities or taking it over. And this process is at least a 30 to 50 year process. This didn't happen overnight. Maybe if we put a plan together and move on it, maybe we can reclaim some of these communities, you know, and with it to keep our culture and our history intact. So that's pretty much all I have to say.
Can I respond?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. I can appreciate the brother's argument, but here's the thing. I don't think we can't be simplistic in analysis. Here's the thing. When you talk about people not having access, you know, to the borrowing, one of the things recently, Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve chairperson, she passed an interest rate increase of 1.25% okay, interest rate. Now, what that did, it did happen in terms of the overall function of the economy in terms of, you know, the supply of money in circulation. It did nothing at all in terms of reducing that or increasing that. But what it did do is cause smaller banks to give up a large amount of their money for reserves. Reserves are simply the money banks give to the Federal Reserve in order to create. So which means that small banks don't have the capital in terms of being able to borrow to anybody, irrespective of the color of their skin. That's the first thing. So what I'm saying is that it's important that we understand that when we talk about, you know, community empowerment, understand that by playing by the same rules that currently exists, doesn't make any sense to me. Because what happens is that even if I own a bank, I have to play by the rules because I work in the context of the system. So what I'm saying is that African people have to start thinking outside the box. Not necessarily replicating what they're trying to do, but thinking outside the box. That's the first thing. I think also the second thing, the brother saying people, we need to stop complaining about the problem and do something about it. The whole problem starts with a collective understanding of what's going on. See, the problem that we're having is we don't even understand what's going on, and so therefore we don't have the correct analysis in terms of resolving our problems. So if I say to the brother, okay, now the problem is that if you really want to resolve this problem in terms of the African people confronting the society, then one of the things that we have to seriously think about is Pan-Africanism. But most of our people don't think in terms of Africanism because they don't understand the connection between in terms of the global economy or the flow of dollars throughout the world, and so therefore they don't see the connection, or even in terms of the vast resources that exist in Africa. So this whining, you have to understand that it's all about clarity in terms of people understanding precisely what it is the world begins and how is it we're going to defeat it. By replicating what the oppressor does, doesn't you're not thinking. That's more thinking inside the box. And what we have to do is think outside the box, which we may not be privy to the financial banking institutions in society. Certainly we can, even if we create our own banks, it doesn't resolve the problems that we face because those banks that exist have to conform to the rules of the oppressor. So it doesn't make sense in terms of replicating something which you know from the very beginning is kind of ridiculous. That could do a damn thing in terms of helping our people move forward. So analysis is important. How we articulate things, you got to be careful. Because one of the things is when you keep saying stuff like, well, people, we just complaining, just talking, we just miss any kind of analysis, which is so important in terms of moving forward. The solution that we're confronted with doesn't necessarily lie in terms of the institutions that currently exist, but outside the institutions that exist. But we have to understand how the institutions, how the society is organized, how we can move around those institutions, and what the kind of things we must do in terms of powering ourselves. And that doesn't have a damn thing to do with terms of legitimization of the social, political, economic structures that currently exist in America, and I concede.
I think, if I may respond, I think a lot of that is valid. I do think, though, it's very similar to a lot of the issues that we are confronted with as black people in this country and throughout the world. And that is, there's no one way to solve anything. We have all types of people with all types of belief systems, ideologies, practices, cultures that are black, some of whom don't even call themselves or see themselves as black. So we have to come, in my opinion, we have to come up with a strategy that is practical in the sense that we can get the most people to buy into it as quickly as possible. A lot of people will not get to the point where they understand all of the deep economics and Pan-African policies. I'm a Pan-African nationalist, so I support you on that. But what I'm saying is, it's just like, if I may use an analogy of schools. You know, I go to these panel discussions, everybody's talking about, okay, black people get miseducated. So you got some people on the panel that will tell you, well, you know, homeschooling is the way. That's the answer. Failing to realize that many people don't have the economic situation where they can stay home and not work to teach their child. Many people don't have the inclination to do so. So, and even if we had all these homeschools, would it be able to solve the problem of 7.7 million school-age black children in this country? Then some people say, well, no, we independent African schools. I support that. African-centered schools. But then we get into the problem of the schools that you can find in this country that call themselves African-centered. Are all of them African-centered? And so some of them are not. So then having an organization that can accredit and say this is truly African-centered, just having a bunch of black people in the school, some red, black, and green flags, and honoring Marcus Garvey doesn't make it African-centered. Where's your disciplinary code? What's the values you're teaching? All of these things. And some people say, you know, no, we just got to rock with the public school system. Our taxes go to it. We got to rock with that. That's what we got. all these different things. And some people say if you keep your kid in the public school system, you're a traitor, you're a sellout. And your kid will be miseducated, not realizing Malcolm X didn't go to an African Senate school. Marcus Garvey didn't go to an African Senate school. Asada Shakur didn't go to an African Senate school. Huey P. Newton didn't go to an African Senate school. How was it? Mary Baraka didn't go. Sonia Sanchez didn't go. So how were they able to develop that consciousness and become warriors in the struggle? This implies that it was a collective effort, that there were, we need after-school programs, we need the brothers and sisters that are teachers that I used to be in the public school classroom. We need those warriors there. Because guess what? Most of our almost 8 million school-age kids have got to go to a public school. And it's going to take a minimum of 20 to 30 years to build enough alternative schools to even accommodate all of those kids. You know, most of them couldn't afford the tuition. So this is why I say I don't like selling anything or seeing anything as having just one approach. All we got to do is this. Or no, there's no all we got to do. There's many things that we need to do. And the people that are pan-African nationalists and they feel we need to partner with Africa, you pursue that. And you sell that, and you work on that. There's other people that say, look, I'm a teacher here. What can I do working in this school with a bunch of white people with this curriculum, with these rules? These people that don't understand our kids and don't love our kids, they need to be equipped with the tools and information to reach our kids because most of them are in the public schools. And then we need the group of people that say, well, I don't know about the going dealing with the our continental African brothers and sisters or people in Brazil. Sounds good, but I want to do something here right now. So those people can look at, some of them can look at home schools, like a Marcus Klein in Chicago. He actually took the concept from, instead of teaching my kids, he opened up community homeschools where he teaches 20 or 30, and he has three different schools. So it's the issue with us of this either-or paradigm or with this failing to understand our people where they are, meeting the people where they are and working with them where they are, and knowing that some people are more advanced, have a more advanced understanding or analysis, and that's fine. But what we need to understand is while all of this debate is going on, right, and the school analogy I'm giving, our kids are being miseducated and dumbed down and having their spirits and culture crushed every day. So what can we do now, what can we start doing now with what we have and what we know to start making a dent in this edifice? And that could be miseducation, that could be gentrification, that could be police brutality. We have to have a multi-level strategy and a strategy that accommodates our people wherever they are in order for this to work. Because everyone will not agree on the analysis and everyone will not agree on the strategy. You see, but if we start where people are, we have something for teachers that's in the school. So, for instance, with gentrification, we got something for people who want to own businesses. We need to reach out to them and get them involved. We need to let people know you need to be in these sites of power, these community boards. You need to be involved with these things. You need to have advanced access to information so we know what's going on. These right here in Harlem, I can tell you for a fact, the people dominating these community boards are Latino and Asian and white. They have advanced access to information. Sometimes you don't even know what's going on. They know what's going on. And they're able to put their people on, and that's what they do. So what I'm saying is simply, I agree with our brother who just spoke. The only thing I want people to understand is it has to be a multi-layered strategy. And the people that are organizing all those strategies need to be in close communication. They need to be meeting regularly to find out how we can make these strategies intersect. You know, it's like talking about revolution versus reform. So we got to have all our revolutions. Okay, cool. Let's say I'm with that. How long is that, knowing where our people are right now, how long will that take? And then you're saying there's nothing we can do now to help until we have this quote-unquote revolution. You have to have a part for people to play. And that's how you build capacity. This is how Ella Baker Smith was so very powerful. By teaching people the skills they needed, as brother said, giving them proper, helping them get to proper analysis, building on their lived experiences, where they were, And they were able to create generations and generations of straight-up soldiers and activists. But one approach is not going to change this. And the people who are not with that approach, they're not going to get involved. So we got to think, how do we engage the community where they are, get them involved, and have a multi-layered strategy that can encompass different approaches, all of which make a dent in this edifice, and while doing that, raise people's consciousness and empower people to do something. Right now, it's hard to sell a lot of things that we all would agree need to be done. People are not there. And the time it takes them to get there, Lord knows how long that's going to be. You see, so that's the only thing I would add. But I don't disagree with anything the brother said.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things is that when we're talking the course of revolutionary struggle, no one would ever say or imply that somehow there's only one strategy that you can take in terms of liberation. No one would ever say that.
They do all the time, brother. All the time.
Personally, I don't know of anybody who's revolutionary who would ever even say such a thing. Because as you
heard people say, it has to be scientific socialism. You haven't heard people say the only way we're going to. Yeah, that happens.
Yeah, I hear you. But they're not negating the fact that, as you say, everybody are not of the same consciousness. So they're not negating
right.
that point. They're
right.
just simply saying that one of the things that we have to look at is maybe revolutionary socialism or maybe Pan-Africanism or whatever it is. But they're
yes,
not negating the fact that given where people are, it's going to dictate their strategy and tactic because that's where their level of understanding. So that can never be negated. Nobody would ever even, at least I know of, that would even attempt to negate that reality. So the only people who want to work. Okay, but for those people who want to run for public office, right, it's not a problem with that. There's no contradiction in that. There's no contradiction at all in terms of that. Because, as a matter of fact, one of the things is that if, in fact, if you can organize folks around the issue in terms of supporting someone, teaches that brother or sister who maybe otherwise wouldn't be involved in political process, then points of organization. So all those things are relevant, and that's not the point. See, all those things are relevant. The point is this. The point is this, and it's a philosophical one. To what extent do we legitimize, inadvertently, the power of the system? When we give legitimacy to the system, doesn't we do it to our own disadvantage? And that's a philosophical question. I think the one that we have to think about when we try to navigate which way forward. Because what happens is that for the brother and sister who think that participating, you know, in the public office is the be and end of all political struggles, then that individual in the final analysis is probably counterproductive in terms of actually being in a position to push the movement forward. But it's a philosophical question. So all I'm saying is that when brothers and sisters are talking about stuff that go on, I have no problem in terms of whatever brothers and sisters say. As long as I know that whatever they're particularly it's lead to a liberation of our people, I'm with it. I don't have a problem with it.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Even though I think ultimately in terms of our solution, because one of the things we need in terms of moving forward, we need to have access to capital, and certainly land will be a big part of it in terms of moving forward. The Republic of Africa talk about the importance of land down south, I'm with that. I have no problem with that, because that land is indispensable. When you start talking about building a nation, so I have no problem with that. When the brothers say talk about the importance of Pan-Africanism and talk about access to resources, if Africa is organized and being able to invest in African communities in America, I'm all with that. That's no problem. It's no problem at all. You see what I'm saying? So my only concern is, like I said, the philosophical one in which we legitimize the system inadvertently without understanding necessarily that we legitimize the system to our own disadvantage. And that is the point that I'm trying to convey here. So I'm hoping that's a little bit clearer in terms of what I'm trying to convey in your response.
No, brother, you are very clear. What I'm attempting to raise is the point from the grassroots organizing view of people who are not quite there. And what's up, young blood? And the time it takes to get people there. And what we can do with said people right now to engage. Let me give an example, if I may deviate, because all of this is interconnected anyway, honestly. And that is, what we're doing in Harlem, starting on February 8th, is we're starting the Harlem Liberation School. Now, it's not a traditional school, grades and graduations and all that, but a community space where people can come twice a month. We'll have panel discussions, workshops, engaging, interactive group activity, film reviews, song reviews, article reviews, sometimes one person stand up and speaking, debates, and then teaching people community organizing skills, and then connecting what we learn to now engaging in actual community organizing and activism. And then bringing all types of people in. So we got the new Black Panther Party is involved. We got the brother and sister that work against so-called black-on-black violence. They're involved. You know, we got people that are a little bit more into the civil rights sort of direct action, nonviolent action sort of techniques, and local getting involved with local politics involved, getting the young people involved. And so some people say, well, brother, that's not going to do it. You're going to have all these people with different ideologies and da-da-da-da. The point, though, is it takes people where they are. People can come in. They learn about some of our ancient African history, African-American history, diaspora history. But they're learning it from the point of view of not to keep it in a history book, but how do we use our history analytically. So for some of those people there for the first time, they now realize Black History Month or our Black history in general is not simply for trivia games. It's not to be able to say, did you know the first black nurse was born in? No, it's not. That's elementary school. As we get older, we got to start engaging our history analytically. We got to start looking at misrepresentations of our leaders. We got to start looking at the blueprint that they provided, what we need to tweak, how we solve our problems, what lessons we learn from the history as we, you know, as we go forward. Now, this is a beautiful thing because what it will do, it involves all types of people in the community. Because, again, we say black solidarity all the time in the political circles. And we may understand that abstractly, but a lot of people on the grassroots, on the masses, have not seen black solidarity, at least not in the direction that we're talking about. You know, when somebody says, let me get some kush, everybody put it in $2 to get a bag, that's black solidarity, but with respect to something meaningless and irrelevant. Let's put in money to go get a hotel suite to have a party. That could be some, but we're talking about black solidarity, the concept we get different types of black people with different types of ideologies, but they're all concerned about improving our condition. And we have disagreements on how that will happen and when that will happen and who will lead it. But it's being able to say building capacity, teach our people that we can work together despite certain disagreements. Some disagreements are irreconcilable, and you will have to part ways on some things, but there's many things that we can work together on. So by doing that, it teaches, it shows the practice instead of us just pontificating about it. And this is what I'm trying to say. We have one of the things we learn is that, with respect to you, brother, I have to disagree. Many people I've heard in these circles have a notion that there is one way, and it's very clear that they believe that in their rhetoric and what they say and what they write. For instance, they'll preface their solution by saying the only way, quite literally, to do so is this way. And what people got to understand is even, like, if you look at black power movement, would there be a black power movement without the antecedent or preceding civil rights movement? Didn't the civil rights movement, though I would critique it as nationalism, being, you know, nonviolence as a way of life, and we have to be nonviolent as opposed to attacking. That's my critique. You know, and I would have critiques of taking white philanthropists' money. I would have a lot of critiques of, but guess nevertheless, what it was able to do was mobilize black people where they were. Where they were. Nurses, teachers, clerks, custodians, all types of black people, different classes of black people. It raised our consciousness collectively. It got people who were not really involved.
church people, political people, atheists, agnostics, all types of people. And from that, how do we get SNCC? Because they're coming from these young college students who want to do something about segregation and the lack of our voting rights. It gets them engaged. But guess what? They go through SNCC and they see, ah, we still got an issue with this racial hegemony. We got an issue with white people coming in and changing the course of what we're trying to do. The promises that we were given about civil rights didn't materialize. We're disillusioned. We're disenchanted. So a lot of those people who started off as nonviolent activists become involved with Black Power. This is how we get Kwame Ture, who was Stokely Carmichael, who was nonviolent direct action. Now he becomes this great Pan-Africanist leader. How does that happen? It happens because he's radicalized and politicized through a whole different movement with whole different aims and objectives. So the history is clear on this, that you have to have mechanisms in the community and people who are forward thinking like this to know everybody's not at this place. Those people who are here, they rock together. But we need somebody that can speak to the average Joe out here who's upset, who knows there's problems, and those problems are principally because they're Black, they're seen as menial or semi-skilled, docile labor, that can speak to them where they are and get them involved. And many of those people, we might critique the other reformers. Are you going to stay in the public schools? Oh, that's reformers, but guess what happens? All throughout history, you see that those people, many of them become radicalized. Look at Sonia Sanchez. Sonia Sanchez is in CORE. She's in the Congress of Racial Equality, right? She meets Malcolm during her activism and meets Malcolm. Next thing you know, she's in the Nation of Islam. This is what I'm saying. People get radicalized during that, but we have to be very practical, and we got to look at the history of how do people become radicalized. And they become radicalized by being involved, by their conscience being raised, by addressing the system, by seeing that their traditional approaches seeking redress of their grievances do not work. They are shut down. This is how Stokely becomes Kwame, and we can't forget that. So that's I'm not disagreeing with you. I just want to complicate it using our history. You know, that's how you get people in.
First started, and I played it with little 45s on a little pot.
Hey, brother, my phone. I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Hello?
Yeah, can you hear?
Yes. You were here?
Yeah, I think my phone is dying. See, I'm in transit, so I'm not back at the lab, you know? But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. I can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, let me just say that, let me give you props, bro, because I'm from 114th in Lenox.
My brother.
So I'm glad to hear you doing some good work up there. You know, I haven't been there for a while. Yeah, so I'm glad to hear that kind of work is taking place in Harlem. I hear you, bro. I hear you. You know, my response to any brother or sister who runs, you know, that anything is absolute. You know, philosophically, I just have to point out that maybe that position is somewhat disingenuous, if not irrational. You know, it's clearly, I mean, you know, we bring different strengths to the table on different levels of understanding. It's to me, it seems counterproductive. I mean, people have to reason, have to come to the realization, you know, that certain things have to take place in order to be free. So I don't think
yes,
you can impose that mindset on anybody.
Yes,
I agree. I think one of the problems that we're confronted with, though, now we have a different paradox, and that is that in society where when we talk about in the 60s and the 50s, you know, even the 30s before the 50s, even the 60s, and we talk about conditions which were ripe in terms of revolution, and so, of course, it had a profound impact on the thinking of a lot of people during that point in time. Now, if we fast forward to the 21st century, now they have the corporate media has absolute control in terms of the kind of views that are propagated on television. People are not the conditions in terms of that are ripe for revolution are non-existent. In fact, those people with positions of power are making damn sure that anything that tends to radicalize people is not presented on television. So, and that's problematic for us. So the question for us is, how do we create that environment,
right?
Which is conducive in terms of radicalizing people and getting people to the point where they realize that certain things have to happen if you're going to be free in society. So how do we do that?
Right, and that, see, that's what I was speaking to. That with the Harlem that type of venue. It's not the only one, and I don't want to be sound overinflated with this and overly ambitious. But that type of venue, there needs to be venues where people come, the average person can come, and they don't have to be Muslim, brother. They don't have to be Christian. They don't have to get beat up over what they believe in. They can come as they are and get fed. And from those, and if we did this in every city, by the way, it takes a month or less to set these types of things up. And if those things, if those venues and community spaces were created all over the country, we would then have a generation, or at least be preparing a generation or generations of warriors and soldiers that are exceedingly clear on what time it is and what must be done. But guess what? Just as important, have the skills to do it. You know, because that's what we're finding. There's people who they're upset, they want to do, but they don't know what to do. They don't have that experience. And the people that they associate with being quote-unquote conscious or evolved on these issues sometimes are not the most welcoming and not the most patient and not the most empathetic with people. I think we can agree on that. They can come off a little bit like they don't remember when they didn't know, when they were a neophyte in it, and they had to ask people questions. They forget that. So a lot of them, a lot of us, I'm saying us colloquially, I don't mean literally, you know, a lot of us sometimes forget. And when we come to the people, we forget there may have been a time when we were one of the ignorant in various ways, and somebody or some agency or organization came to us. I look at a Malcolm. Malcolm got fed when he was young, but he got disconnected from that due to the fragmentation of his family. So now he's in the street. What would Malcolm have been if there were no Nation of Islam in existence? Well, he would have, most likely, he would have been like the majority of our brothers that go to jail. He would have been a victim of recidivism. Out, back in. Out, back in. But because there was something in place that could teach, he was able to reform and rehabilitate and then become one of our greats. What I'm suggesting is, simply, and to answer the question, I don't have all the answers, but I think a key part is, how do we get a solid core group of our people to see the importance of their black consciousness, political consciousness, radical, militant, and even at the highest level, revolutionary activity? Most people are not going to get there through books. Some do. Most people are not going to get there simply through lectures, though some do. I think most people get there through a combination of they read, they see a lecture. Today they would see it most likely on YouTube to, you know, show you where the technology is. And they interact with people. And they go through life, real lived experiences. And they try it their way. Brothers like me, you say, brother, you ain't never going to get this white man or this capitalist system to hear you. Stop appealing to their humanity. Stop trying to prove your humanity to these people, man. That's a waste of your time. They're not going to hear that, brother. They're going to go, and they're going to do what they were trained to do. And when they go and do that, something happens, and they come back and say, you know what, you was right. I tried to, and some of those people become radicalized through the process. We all come to it differently. The key is getting them to it, which is responding to your question. And what I think is we're too fragmented. We're very impractical, very impractical. We expect, because we said it or wrote it, the people going to get it and be ready to run. We forget that revolution takes some time. Certain circumstances, if the circumstances are not there, then you may have to create them. You may have to heighten the contradictions, whatever. But my point is we have to create vehicles where we get people and we break through this fragmentation. We break through. You gotta see it like me to be down with this. You got to wear this to be down with this. You got to reference this leader to be down with this. It's fragmenting us, and this is why the so-called conscious community is one of the biggest problems outside of white supremacy and global hegemony. They're one of the biggest problems because everybody is fractured. They think their way is the way, and they're trying to recruit people to their particular organization, their particular tribe, and they're not seeing the point of the black solidarity, seeing people where they are and raising their consciousness through a whole bunch of different ways and get them there. They are being maybe more revolutionary. There's things I can't put on Facebook, I can't put in a book. People not, some of them are simply not ready. But if I could say, for instance, to some of the young brothers around my way, like in their 20s, some of them are, you know, involved with criminal activity, let's say street pharmaceuticals. So I come to them hitting in the head with Garvey and Malcolm off the cuff. They're not prepared to hear that. But if I say, I see y'all stand on this stoop all day, the stoop where your family lives, this and that, you're drinking to do this and that. Did y'all ever think that maybe you could have your own buildings? I see y'all go to this Puerto Rican bodega every day. I see y'all go to this every day. Did you ever think that maybe you could put something here or put the money towards something that would help your people? And then they'll think. And then they'll come back. And now we can have further conversation. Because I haven't hit them in the head with my particular politics that's more evolved than theirs. And I think that's how Malcolm was able to push for people. That's how he was able to get people. Because he understood that. Brother, are you still in Harlem, by the way? Do you still live in Harlem?
No, bro. I haven't been there for a long while. I've been away for about 15 years now. So it's been a while.
Oh, man. Where are you now?
Yeah, I'm in Virginia now.
Oh, man.
But as I listen to your talk, though, I'm reminded of the fact as a young ignorant brother, a lot of very revolutionary individuals in New York City who took an interest in me, who gave me tons of books to read. And I'll never call them. But
I wish I could meet you and be there with you, brother. That's what I was saying. I'm a little disappointed you're not still here.
Well, I really know this is a victim of gentrification, you know. So. I would love to come back up there. If I had the means to do that, I would be back tomorrow. But I just don't have the means to do that. So I'm sort of stuck.
Yes, sir.
Yes, so I just make the best of a bad situation and try to organize folks around here.
Let's try to connect, man. After this show, brother, please.
Okay.
My phone is dying. That's why I'm trying to get all this out, y'all. I'm afraid I'm gonna get disconnected soon.
Okay, yeah, we appreciate you.
Well, the sister got the telephone number, so you always can get it from her.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
That's what's up.
Dr. Jones, you still here? Dr. Jones, going on?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I am still here. I am still driving. Hey. If that gives you any idea how big Houston is.
Wow.
I have not made it home yet.
Well, how about this? We've got about 15 minutes left in the stream, everybody. What I would like to do is make sure that everyone has had an opportunity to speak. So did everyone that's here have a chance, an opportunity to chime in?
Hello?
070? Yeah. Yes. Welcome.
Go right ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead. Your mic is open. We can hear you. Your mic is open.
Okay. How about this? I'm going to take a quick break because we haven't had an opportunity to do that. The flow was going so strong, and we definitely appreciate y'all's energy tonight. And, we're going to make sure that we maintain this contact because this is what it's going to take, y'all, to have these conversations and, you know, agree where we can and talk tonight. So you're listening to Time of the Times Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC and the New Power Radio Network. We're looking for additional hosts and broadcasters too, y'all, so keep that in mind as we proceed. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
Put this on YouTube.
Yeah.
You heard this, dude.
I believe our greatest need as a people is to educate our youth. I believe that we need to move from all of the individuals and groups who are doing great things in their communities to uplift kids through better education, but we need to move from fragmentation to consolidation to coalition. They are simply products that help to create awareness.
Anytime you can put a symbol on a t-shirt that symbolizes unity, that's what we're doing.
Something for people to rally around. I use the colors of red, black, and green to reconnect African American youth with their culture. How do you know where you're going if you don't know where you've been and what you've been through as a people? At best, we are strongest together. And in that sense, I am driven and passionate about talking to as many people and groups all over this country who, again, want to help to maximize the mission, want to help to move forward our kids with better educational opportunities.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. This is Tuesday night here on Sign of the Times with Dr. James. Queen Tahira and Brother Tahimbe. Welcome back, everybody. Your mics are open. Dr. Jones, I yield to you.
Yes, ma'am. Just arrived home, so I'm actually getting out the car right now. But the brothers have done a masterful job. They're both most certainly master teachers, and, you know, you just kind of wish and wonder what could happen if, Brother Hockey was still in Harlem. They'd probably turn Harlem back black before it was all said and done. But, we can only wish, and the Lord knows why we're placed where we're placed. But dealing with one of the tangents that rose up in regards to the discussion tonight, and it is the idea of quote-unquote freedom schools and what have you, and the desperate need for black folk to educate their own. It can come in a myriad of ways because, I felt a sense of pride when I heard the brother breaking down that Malcolm didn't go to Afrocentric school, neither did Marcus Garvey, that there were a host of factors that led to their developing their political consciousness. And that resonates with me because I can tell you that there were so many different factors that pointed me towards that way. Myself, I graduated from a Catholic high school that had 4 African-Americans in the senior class when I graduated. So it is definitely a God-given gift to be surrounded by a community that even under those circumstances could equip you and politicize you and let you know that to whom much was given, much is going to be required. And I yield with that.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I argue precipitously, is this whole question in terms of creating an environment which is conducive toward, critical thinking. One of the things, when we look at the devolution of schools, and we looked at a situation where kids are no longer encouraged to be critical thinkers, where in essence kids are conditioned, to articulate more the same. It's a problem. So anything that we can do that's going to hyphen kids' ability to critique is sorely needed. One of the things, if you ask kids a question these days, they're more likely to express, verbatim exactly, what the teacher told them, to express. And we ask them to extrapolate, to go into depth in terms of just what you're saying, kids are totally confused. And it's a reflection of the economic system as it currently exists. The only people who are being served in terms of that kind of inability to be critical
is the ruling class. They want a population who's ill-equipped to be critical in terms of their analysis. That's precisely what they want. And that's precisely what's going on, why our kids are so confused. They know there's something fundamentally wrong. They just can't make sense of it when you try to tell them, say, well, you know what? Could it be all this poverty exists because people want poverty to exist? With kids, which totally baffles a lot of kids because they don't understand where they're coming from. In their mind, people are poor simply because they lack initially like drive, or they're somehow uneducated, or any myriad of reasons in terms of justifying why people are impoverished. So kids have no critical understanding in terms of the world which they live in, and that's by design. So we got our work cut out for us. And the more independent schools that we can create to teach kids to be critical thinkers, then that's something we in desperate need of. So I definitely encourage people to create independent schools or even independent institutions which are going to teach, you know, kids to be critical. And one of the things that we're working on, we're trying to create a studio, video, you know, teach kids to do video filming and stuff like that. And I'm also trying to create a school where they teach kids musical instruments, in particular guitar, violin, and the guitar, violin, and maybe the saxophone, which I was thinking about, but that might be when they're young, saxophone might be a bit tough for them. But the whole question in terms of theory, in terms of understanding fluidity, in terms of understanding information and being able to process that information which they receive. So those are things that we really need. So this, the notion in terms of our kids being able to critically analyze is extremely important. So anything that's going to push that process forward, I support 110%. You see that? See that, Queen?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I mean, wrong. I was yielding. I was going to let it flow. But thank you, you know, everybody for your responses and comments. I'd like to say, because I also work with young people here in an urban environment in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I had a young man who was about 8 years old at the time, and we're sitting at the table coloring, and he says to me, if I live to get big, I want to be an attorney. And he, like I said, he couldn't be no more than 8 years old. And I thought to myself, if I live to get big, you mean to tell me that that's the mindset of our youth, if they live to get big? And then here recently, I hear talk of this some sort of suicide game that the young people are playing that is really having an impact in the tri-state area where I live, which is Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana. We're right there on that tip of the border of all three states. So they consider this a tri-state area. They said it's really high here, that these young people are playing this suicide game. So if we're raising young people, and not all of them have the same mindset, I'm not going to say, you know, broad brush paint all of our young people, but some of them do, to where they don't see themselves getting to be old and gray, because so many of our young people are passing away to violence and other means. You know, how many children will we really be able to calculate are going to pass away or get sick as a result of what's happening in Flint right now? Because they said that the water that was coming through was, in some cases, leveling at the percentage of toxic waste. And these people have been subjected to this for over almost 2 years now. So, you know, we've got children who are coming up in this kind of world. I wanted to ask you, brothers, how can we, I guess, restore their faith in us as adults and elders in the community? And how can we get them to be able to better visualize themselves being everything that they can possibly be? And I yield with that.
You know, Queen, I think it's critical that if we're going to do that, and it's definitely a laudable and worthy aspiration to have, we simply have to change the context and the environment that birth that doubt that our children are seemingly imbued with, the idea that they are actually not going to be able to grow up, that they're not going to be able to see these things that they should naturally see. There should be no question about that. So my answer to that is a very simple one, and it is quite simply change the context, change the diet, change the things that are going into them that are causing them to go ahead and lose faith, not only in humanity and society, but sadly in us as well. And I yield with that.
I concur. I think to some extent, in order to facilitate that, it's going to call for some self-critique among adults. One of the things we have to understand that the things we do, there are does impact on the way our young people see themselves. And so as a community, then we have to fundamentally change a lot of the things that we do. No longer can we afford, business as usual and not understand the repercussions of our behaviors. So I think a lot of adults in the community do all kinds of self-destructive stuff, not even being cognizant of the fact, that young people, even though, they may not sit back and have a long conversation with you in terms of their observation, nonetheless does impact on them. It does impact on their perceptions in terms of what it is to be a young African man or young African boy, young African girl, in the neighborhood. So I think it's going to take, like I said, it's going to take a great deal of self-critique on the part of the community. I think that's where institutions are so important, because these questions never get asked. And so without institutions, there is really no there's no platform in the community that affords us the impetus to even engage those kind of questions. So as a consequence, we keep doing self-destructive stuff, not understanding that our self-destructive behavior does impact on our young people, and it colors their perceptions, the way they see the world, the way they even see themselves. So institutions, I think, are very, very key in terms of trying to bring about that reality that Doc talked about in terms of what's best for our young people.
All right, y'all. Well, another night comes to a close here on Sign of the Times. I hope that those who have chosen to be a part of tonight's dialogue and conversation will continue to have these conversations with the people that are closest around them, because we are a national movement, the UAC, but everything that we do relies on those people who are being a part of what we're building to pull those in who are closest to them, and a lot of times, that's our family and friends first. So, spread this conversation and let's do this again. Let's continue to talk about this. Let's continue to build. What's the next step? Is the big question that I always ask. What's the next step? And so thank you, brother, for being a part of tonight's conversation. Thank you, Dr. Jones. Thank you to all the listeners. And for those who chose not to chime in, hopefully, you will still continue to listen and just, think about it. So, thank you, everybody. We'll see you probably tomorrow. My brother is in hospice, and I ask that you all please send me and my family lots of good energy and prayers. So I don't know if I'm going to do a live session tomorrow or not, but definitely we'll be back on Thursday and Friday here on Sign of the Times. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and close out. Thank you, Dr. Jones. I love you. We'll talk to y'all soon. Peace.
Love you as well. Right, peace.
Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, explains the genealogy of Shem. Shem was a black man in Africa. If you repeat this fact, they can't laugh at you.
Get out of there, guys.
14, verse 13.
What are you doing?
Abraham.
accept everything that you're telling us. What are you selling us? The creator's dwelling us. I'm seeing your unknown past while you're failing us. I failed to track this fighting with your reason. You're trying to make me you by season. Off my mind with CJ Run. See John Rock in a hardcore New York. Come on now, it's like a chocolate cow. It doesn't exist, no way, no how. It seems to me that in the foolish ebony, African history should be puffed up steadily, but it's not. And this has got to stop. See spot, run, run, get a spot. Insulting to a black mentality, a black way of life, or a jet black family. So I include with one concern that you must learn.
Yo, Chris.
Whoa. Hold up, see. Hold up, see. We're gonna see if they're really ready for this. Are y'all having fun tonight? I said, are y'all having fun tonight? I believe that if you teach in history, deal with straight up facts, no mystery. Teach the student what needs to be taught. Cause black and white can both take short. When one doesn't know about the other one's culture, ignorance boots down like a vulture. Cause you don't know that you ain't just a janitor. No one told you about Benjamin Banneker, a brilliant black man that invented the almanac. Here to see what KRS is coming at? With Eli Whitney, Holly Selassie, Granville Woods made the walkie talkie. Louis Vladimir improved on Edison. Charles Drew did a lot for medicine. Garrett Morgan made the traffic light. Harriet Tubman sees the blaze at night. Madam CJ Walker made the straightening comb. But you won't know this if you weren't shown. The point I'm getting at, it might be hard, is we're just walking around brainwashed. See what I'm saying? It's not to diss a man. We need the 89 school system, one that caters to a black return. Because you must learn.
What up, cameraman?
The DSR Hall! We're not through with the ragga stuff. We're not through with the ragamuffin stuff yet, man. Akebulon is the original name of Africa, now stripped of its fame. It's good to know that in ancient times, Egyptians developed all sciences of the mind, to the point where they ruled the planet. But Rome, Greece, and Persia wasn't having it. They attacked and won the war, but it wasn't enough. They had to get to the core. Cause in that time, it was Akebulon that moved religion, politics, and man. In order to destroy the Egyptian race, they had to wipe the sciences from off the face of the planet. So they proceeded to banish and replace it with Christianity. And it's been that way all the way to today. Learn what we teach, hear what we say. But here comes the case of the S, the O, the N, the E, the B, the P, and we rhyme intelligently. Let me continue with Theodosius, a Greek ruler not known to most of us. He, in the 4th century A.D., called the Egyptians fools, you see. 2 years later, Justinian ruled. 6 A.D., was it for school? As a result, ignorance had swirled over Christian Europe and Greco-Roman world. This went on for 1,000 years of ignorance, stupidity, and tears. Now comes the 17th century hardness. Europe began to come out of its darkness. So Johann F. Blumenbach, a German, came out of nowhere and started confirming white supremacy and men of color. Before this time, all men were brothers. It was Johann who went on to say, there are 5 different colors in the world today. That's Caucasian, Malayan, and Mongolian, American Indian, and Ethiopian. Yet, the ignorance gets scarier. He believed white was superior. According to his idiotic fountain, the purest whites were from the Caucasus Mountains. J.A. Govender and H.S. Chamberlain both supported this outrageous racism. This went on to what the master race should be and why they killed the Jews in Germany. Here is the reason why I'm so concerned, because you must learn. We're not done. We're not done. We're not done. Check this out.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, 2 self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge, Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.